Hi guys, welcome to Lock Your Doors, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Allison, and this is my guest, Amy.
Hi guys.
Today, we're going to be talking about a couple of reasons why you should lock your door, such as the most unforgettable 80s crime. The 1980s are known for music, loud colors, fashion, and amongst other things, serial killers. Yay, how fun. Because of that, the 80s have been given its status as the deadliest decade. The number of serial killers exceeded 200 in the 80s. By the 90s, the number of cases dropped to 141, and then to 61 by the 2000s.
Wow, not to be paranoid, but all of these true crime podcasts and shows and movies, it just, you know, kind of motivated me to add extra locks to my own door.
Of course, everything is just terrible, what happened in the past, and people should be aware of what's going on.
Definitely, and like prevent it in the future, so yeah.
So shall we begin our countdown?
Let's do it.
5. Herbert Baumeister. In the late 80s and 90s, Herbert Baumeister would lure gay men back to his pool house, then strangle them to death and dump them into the woods behind his home. Baumeister had his pool area decorated with mannequins that were set up to seem like they were having a pool party. Baumeister's young son, Eric, even stumbled upon the remains of one victim while he was playing in the backyard. Once Baumeister realized the police were onto him, he fled to Canada and shot himself in the head at Provincia Park. In his suicide note, he blamed his failing marriage and business as the reason for his suicide and never confessed to any of the murders. Police estimate that he killed somewhere between 10 to 20 people.
Oh my god. So this man would just like murder people and bury them in your backyard. Like, couldn't the police say, you know, like just go back there and like dig up the bones to see exactly how many people he murdered?
Yeah, and also I got creeps from the mannequins.
Yeah, the mannequins. Yeah, it was terrible. Like, and his son just like, oh, what is this? A bone? A skull? Like, just ugh.
Terrifying. You'll be traumatized by that.
Yeah, for real. It is terrible.
On to our next case.
At number 4, we have Bobby Joe Long. That sounds like an interesting Midwestern name. In the early 1980s, he raped dozens of women after using newspaper ads to find victims. By the spring of 1984, he committed his first murder. Initially just looking to fulfill his sexual needs, Long picked up a young prostitute named Artis Wick. After assaulting and raping Wick, he decided that he wasn't fulfilled. Oh, you know, there's nothing as fulfilling as rape and murder, you know? So he strangled and killed her. In May 1984, while driving on Nebraska Avenue in Tampa, again Florida, wow.
Florida.
Long spotted a young woman walking named Lana Long. He pulled up to Lana and offered her a ride, which she accepted. But he soon pulled his car off the road and took out a knife. Lana began screaming and attempting to fight. He tied her up and drove to a more remote road where he raped and strangled her. Yeah, I never accept rides from a stranger. That is like the number one rule book of danger. Although, I mean, in the 80s, it was like really common for people to just, you know, like hitchhike and take rides from strangers because it was supposed to be, I don't know, why all these serial killings happened at the same time, but it was supposed to be, you know, safe.
And people were more like free will.
Yeah.
They let their children out. There wasn't no phone back then, no technology, so there was no way to contact people.
GPS or like tracking devices or anything like that. So yeah, but like also, you know, if all of these like terrible things are happening, because this is all, you know, throughout the 80s, like why would you get in a car with a stranger? Yeah, anyway, so according to police, Lana Long's body was found face down a few days later, her hands bound behind her back and her legs spread far apart. Officers measured 5 feet from one heel to another. Oh, this poor girl.
That's crazy. That's insane.
After luring her to his car, Long beat and raped her before slashing her throat repeatedly. Ah! Detectives connected Sims' murder to Lana Long's when the same material, a red nylon fiber, was found on both women. Police then discovered Long's fourth victim, Elizabeth Loudenbach, some say 17 days after she was killed. Loudenbach's body was badly decomposed when detectives found her, and she was lying on her back, fully clothed. According to police, Loudenbach was different from Long's other victims, as she was not a drug user, prostitute, or stripper. It was around 2 a.m. on November 3rd, 1984. Lisa McVeigh, 17, had just worked a double shift at a Tampa Krispy Kreme and was bicycling home when a car drove by and blew its horn. Odd, she thought, as the car then pulled into a church parking lot. As McVeigh pedaled past the parking lot, she was yanked from her bike by what she thought was a gang of men and forced into the car. She soon realized she was alone with a lone stranger. The stranger blindfolded her and pressed a gun to her head, threatening to kill her if she didn't comply with his every command. He took her to an apartment and proceeded to rape her repeatedly over a 24-hour period.
Crazy. That's insane.
That is brutal. Fearing for her life, McVeigh tried to appeal to her kidnapper's ego and the speck of humanity she hoped he had. She had to get home to take care of her sick father, she told him. But she knew he was a good guy deep down, and she wanted to be his proper girlfriend. She promised she wouldn't tell anyone what happened. The tactic worked, and McVeigh was dropped off by the kidnapper near her home. Police investigating the kidnap didn't think to connect it to the serial slayings that had been plaguing the Tampa area since spring of that year. However, McVeigh had provided a brief description of her assailant and his car. And on November 6, 1984, Long was arrested at a movie theater not far from his Tampa home. The mysterious red fibers for which helped police connect the murders was found to match the interior carpeting of his car. Once in custody, Long was also connected to recently discovered murder of Vicki Elliott. April 1985, Long was convicted of first-degree murder in the Virginia Johnson case and was sentenced to death. Later that year, Long pleaded guilty to 8 Hillsborough County murders. Long was convicted of the other 8 murders in Hillsborough County, among several charges. Bobby Joe Long was on Florida's death row since 1986 and executed by lethal injection on May 23rd of this year. Surviving victim Lisa McVeigh now works as a sheriff's deputy for Hillsborough County.
Wow, good for her.
Yeah, good for her. She survived. She was able to, you know, manipulate him and...
Yeah, that was smart thinking.
Yeah, although, I mean, it doesn't work all the time, but lucky for her, it did this time. It's, yeah, no, it's terrible.
This guy's brutal.
Kidnapping them, raping them, he just, you know, didn't feel fulfilled.
What an excuse.
Yeah. I just, you know, at least he got death row, but he was executed this year, or at least in 2020. So it's always in Florida.
Florida has a lot of history with serial killer, just like such as Ted Bundy and various other ones that people aren't aware of, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you have to be more vigilant, especially like these small towns, tiny cities. Always need to be careful.
On to our next case.
Okay, so now we are actually rounding on the top three. We have Jeffrey Dahmer. And I feel like, you know, a lot of people know the name, but it's just so interesting to kind of break down, you know, his history and what he's done. And there's also a fun fact. This one also has a movie.
Oh, really?
That I think came out like a couple of years ago. So it's pretty recent, pretty cool. Jeffrey Dahmer was an American serial killer who took the lives of 17 males between 1978 and 1991. Over the course of more than 13 years, Dahmer sought out men, mostly African Americans, at gay bars, malls, and bus stops, lured them home with the promise of money or sex, and gave them alcohol laced with drugs before strangling them to death. He would then engage in sex acts with the corpse before dismembering them and disposing of them, often keeping their skulls or genitals as souvenirs. That is so disturbing.
Disgusting.
Yeah, disgusting, disturbing on so many levels.
I can't believe this actually is real. There's a person who likes doing this type of stuff.
Yeah, there's just, you know, a bunch of crazies out there. Yeah. So he frequently took photos of his victims at various stages of the murder process. Wow, he was a very organized person. Mm-hmm. He liked to document his process. Wow. So he could recollect each act afterwards and relive the experience of, you know, killing people and tearing them to pieces.
That's just disgusting.
Though Dahmer had a normal childhood, he became withdrawn and uncommunicative as he got older. Due to his parents' unfolding divorce that summer, Jeffrey was left in the family home alone. He seized the opportunity to act on dark thoughts that had been growing in his mind. It was just 3 weeks later that the 18-year-old committed his first murder. He picked up a hitchhiker, again, people do not hitchhike, named Stephen Hicks, and offered to take him back to his father's house to drink beer. But when Hicks decided to leave, Dahmer hit him in the back of the head with a 10-pound dumbbell. Dahmer then dissected, dissolved, pulverized, and scattered the now imperceptible remains throughout his backyard, and later admitting to killing him simply because he wanted Hicks to stay. I mean, couldn't you just have asked? Like, hey dude, you want to stay? Like, ugh. And also, how long was he left alone if he could, you know, not only kill the guy, but open him up by dissection and then dissolve him, so like basically, you know, boil and you know, like dissolve his body, pulverize, so like, you know, beating him to tiny particles, and then scatter them like as if he was, you know, scattering sunflower seeds throughout his backyard. Like I know that your parents were getting a divorce, but where was your parent? Like, what?
Where was anyone? And honestly, picking it up, clean it up, just another regular day, forgetting about it. Just another.
Oh, like, I want to know if at that moment, you know, there was a neighbor who happened to look outside the window and was just like, oh, there's young Jeffrey Dahmer. He's taken to gardening, you know, just sprinkling seeds on his garden. When it's like, no, ma'am, that is a human,
a dead body,
So it wasn't actually until September 1987 that Dahmer took his second victim, Stephen Twomey. They checked into a hotel room and drank, and Dahmer eventually awoke to find Twomey dead, with no memory of the previous night's activities. He bought a large suitcase to transport Twomey's body to his grandmother's basement, where he dismembered and masturbated on the corpse before disposing of the remains. Yuck. Only after Dahmer killed another two victims at his grandmother's home did she tire of her grandson's late night and drunkenness, although she had no knowledge of his other activities. So, I mean, I guess grandparents obviously, like, you know, respect their grandkids' privacy, but did he not make any noise while, like, dragging down a body to the basement or, like, getting rid of the body?
And plus, doesn't, like, the grandma, like, go down to the basement to check, like, what he's doing or any, like, there's probably been smell of something.
Like, some sort of sign. Although maybe she might have not been able to go downstairs since, you know, she's an elderly woman. So going up and down stairs to the basement or something may have been difficult for her. But like, yeah, like noises or smells or something. It's just a little weird, a little inconsistent there. Anyways. In March 1989, he lured, drugged, strangled, photographed, dismembered, and disposed of Anthony Sears, an aspiring model. At his trial for getting caught molesting a child in May 1989, Dahmer argued in his own defense about how he had seen the error of his ways and that his arrest marked a turning point in his life. Sure.
No excuse for that.
His defense counsel argued that he needed treatment, not incarceration, and the judge agreed, handing down a one-year prison sentence on day release, allowing Dahmer to work at his job during the day and return to the prison at night, as well as a 5-year probationary sentence. That is so nice of the judge. Oh, judge. How nice of you. However, Dahmer was granted an early release by the judge after serving only 10 months of his sentence. He briefly lived with his grandmother following his release. Over the following 2 years, Dahmer's victim count accelerated, bringing his total from 4 to 17. He developed rituals as he progressed, experimenting with chemical means of disposal and often consuming the flesh of his victims. Ah, so he would eat them. Another cannibal. Lovely. I think there's like a deeper psychological thing of like, you know, of having the power over your victim, and like you literally eating them is like you consume them and you know, like exerting your power, I guess. It's just some sick, twisted psychological thing. So Dahmer also attempted crude lobotomies. Wow, so he thought he was also a neurosurgeon, I guess. Drilling into victims' skulls while they were still alive and injecting them with muriatic acid. On July 22, 1991, Dahmer lured Tracy Edwards into his home with the promise of cash in exchange for his company. While inside, Edwards was then forced into the bedroom by Dahmer with a butcher knife. During the struggle, Edwards was able to get free and escape out into the streets, where he flagged down a police car. Good for you, Edwards. When the police arrived at Dahmer's apartment, Edwards alerted them to the knife that was in the bedroom. Upon entering the bedroom, the officers found the pictures of dead bodies and dismembered limbs that allowed them to finally place Dahmer under arrest. Further investigation of the home led them to find a severed head in the refrigerator and 3 more severed heads throughout the apartment. Multiple photographs of the victim and more human remains in his refrigerators. What?
It's like a museum for him.
He like, collected, like, they were like little souvenirs. I'll just, keep your head so you can keep me company. A total of 7 skulls were found in his apartment, as well as a human heart in the freezer. An altar was also constructed with candles and human skulls in his closet. After being taken into custody, Dahmer confessed and began divulging the gruesome details of his crimes to the authorities. Dahmer was indicted on 50 murders charges, and the trial began on January 30, 1992. Even though the evidence against him was overwhelming, Dahmer pled insanity as his defense due to the nature of his incredibly disturbing and uncontrollable impulses. I mean, yeah, he has to be insane, but like, where's the line between, claiming insanity and that being, like a good excuse versus claiming insanity, but you're murdering people? Like, no.
No excuse for that.
Yeah, so. Following 2 weeks of trial, the court declared him sane and guilty on 50 counts, 15 counts of murder. He was sentenced to 15 life terms for a total of 957 years in prison. Well, I guess you can say he's not getting out of it.
Anytime soon.
No. In May of the same year, he entered a guilty plea for the murder of his first victim, Stephen Hicks, and received an additional life sentence. Dahmer served his time at the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage, Wisconsin. He was attacked twice by fellow inmates when the first attempt to slit his neck open, leaving him with only superficial wounds. However, he was attacked a second time on November 28, 1994, by an inmate as they cleaned one of the prison showers. Dahmer was found still alive, but died on the way to the hospital from severe head trauma.
Well, that it isn't justice, but at the same time, he had it coming.
Like killing so many people, eating them like a cannibal, and then pleading insanity. It's not, does not, not, you know, does not go well together. And well, like he was brave enough to do all those killings out of the prison, I guess, when you're with people who have also committed crimes, you're not such a big hot shot anymore. At least, although like you don't even know, because again, I feel like the justice system is so skewed that like sure they gave him, what was it? Nine, a total of 957 years in prison. But then again, all of these things of like, oh, good behavior and like more like plea deals and things like that. Like, it's a risk of them having let him go, which is insane. But,
He's calling the shots.
yeah. But, yeah, so that's Jeffrey Dahmer. I'm surprised he didn't make his way down to Florida, but yeah.
All right, we're now our last two. So, do you have any idea what these two people have done compared to this guy?
Aside from what we've seen, which is kidnapping, raping, and killing, what else? Surprise me.
You're about to be amazed by this next guy. On to our next case. 2, the Toy Box Killer. David Parker Ray kidnapped, raped, and tortured dozens of women from approximately the mid-80s to the 90s when New Mexico law enforcement finally captured him after Cynthia Jarmillo is running for her life on a dirt road, covered in blood, wearing nothing except for a metal choker collar padlock to her neck like an escaped animal. He soundproofed a truck trader that he called his so toy box and equipped it with items used for sexual torture. No one knew exactly what he's doing in his toy box, devoted specifically to sexual torture of his victim. Ray used drugs and brainwashing techniques to prevent the woman from remembering exactly what happened in the trailer.
What? So, like, he, like... He, what do you mean brainwashing? Like, he, like, what? How do they not remember?
Yeah, he used, like, these brainwashing techniques, like, pills, and also, like... I don't know what it's called, but, like, music type? I don't know.
Wow, that is next level. Okay, continue.
To create his trailer, he spent upward of $100,000 on torture device and tools. Reportedly, Ray constructed elaborate contraptions to confine his victim, such as a fur-lined coffin.
That sounds like a not-so-fun time.
Crazy. Like, imagine just going to, like, a trailer, not knowing what you're getting into, and just seeing all these type of things. Instruments? Wait, hold on. In addition to medical instruments and sex toys, Ray bots contain elaborate locks and pulleys to prevent his captives from escaping. Ray sexually tortured and presumably killed his victim using whips, chain, pulleys, straps, clamps, leg spreader bars, surgical blades, and saw.
What? Yeah, that sounds, again, like not a very fun time, unlike, you know, Rihanna's whips and chains excite her. I don't think she'd be really excited with this one.
Yeah, that's just crazy. And you know, saws were first made to, like, for pregnant women to open them up.
Yeah, I read that and I was completely horrified. Like, I don't even want to imagine how
he used it.
How that, yeah, how that went about. Oh no. Ugh. Okay. continue. Tell me more.
He terrorized many women with these toys for many years while living in New Mexico. Ray lived in a small New Mexico town of 1,300 people, and with them close proximity to state park and lake. He had access to miles of abundance as well as a reservoir where police believe he could have dumped his victim's body without any witness. Ray was playing a torture game with 60 women killed by him.
60 women? That is... a lot. That is horrifying.
To prevent women from reporting the crime, he drugged them with agents to induce amnesia. He made a tape recorder of himself telling one woman that the drugs were sodium pentoate and
phenobarbital. Yeah. Oh.
One woman remained uncertain that her recollections of the abuse were nightmares. Until she was contacted by the FBI.
What? That is how? I mean, yeah, I guess, like, you know, chemically induced amnesia, but, like, who even thinks of that? Like, who even, like, knows how to do that? That's crazy. That's, like, a mind wipe. Like, that is terrible. Like, that just goes to show you that the mind is a powerful thing, but also a very fragile thing. Yeah.
After questioning, she came up to remember her mistreatment scene details. Even though Ray was only tried for 3 murders in 2001, the courts decided to put Ray through 3 separate trials, one for each of his living victims. Cynthia, Angelica, and Kevin. You know, it took this long for them to capture him and put him on trial. That's just insane.
Not only that, but he was only tried for 3 murders. He killed 60 women. What do you mean just 3?
Ray eventually agreed to plea deal and received a 224-year prison sentence. Ray agreed to show authorities where he had buried his victims, but heart attack in 2002 at the age of 63, taking the knowledge of their burials to his grave.
Wow. Another one that dies. How convenient.
And I didn't include this, but he also had another partner. in crime. She was also into these type of murders, type of like a little kink. I can't even say if it's a kink, but it's just another type that she was also liking it. So she would lure out a woman saying, fine, he's great, it's okay, you're with me. And then after also being part of this terrible thing.
That's insane. See, like, that also is just like, wow, like, to have women also, you know, be part of something so terrible. But it goes to show you, you don't know can't people, trust anyone. And you can't really trust mm-hmm. anybody. Right, so we've made it to number one. So who is number one?
Number one is also another chilling person. A case that really, you know, haunts you. One of the most prolific, vicious serial murders to have terrorized the street of Los Angeles in the 1980s was Richard Ramirez. Now, Netflix Night Stalker Searching for Serial Killer Dog series dwells into how, after a year, police eventually caught the killer after he tried to escape law enforcement. Ramirez, first known as the Walk-in Killer, invaded homes, murdering and sexualizing, assaulting the resident from June 1984 to August 1985. He used a wild variety of weapons, including handguns, knives, a machete, a tire iron, and a hammer, as well as a satanic imagery. Ramirez never expressed any remorse for his crimes. He had a pattern when killing. He killed a man in a house and sexually assaulted a woman, and always made sure he could see the fear in his victim's eye.
Wow, that's sick and twisted.
Yeah, he also had these teeth that look like vampires. It's not something to look at. In the early days of his crimes, he knocked on the car hood of Maria Hernandez so she would see him before the attack. He yanked tossing lame Veronica Yu out of her car as opposite to shooting her through the window. In Wither, he cut out Matson Zara's eyes and took them with him. Another victim. Investigator identified him as an enraged killer because of how vicious his victims had been killed. In one case, the victim Patty Higgins was slashed and stabbed in the throat. Another victim, Florence Nettie Lang, 81, was beaten to death with a hammer. When he continued his killing spree in San Francisco Bay Area, police said in the documentary that he killed an accountant named Peter Pan and raped his wife Barbara and ate everything in the fridge, threw up on the kitchen floor, and masturbated on the living room floor, and then wrote a satanic symbol on the wall. I feel so bad for all his victims. They didn't deserve this kind of death.
Not only that, but it was just like so gruesome. And this is why, once again, you should lock your doors, because this guy just literally would walk into your home. And find actually like ways to get into your house, even if it wasn't through your doors, it was through like windows or like your backyard. Like, it's just that is terrifying.
By the mid-80s, there was a cultural belief in America that heavy metal music correlated with evil cult. The band Judas Priest was accused of creating music that inspired teenagers to kill in the late 1985, and Congress was also manic rituals involving children. I mean, back in the 80s, there was a lot of, you know, satanic killing. Like, if you guys don't know of the Acid Keen, who was also, you know, related to these type of stuff and would kill everyone in sight, even his friends.
Wow, that is like, it's just, it goes to show how much influence the things you listen, see, and surround yourself with have in you. And like, and not to say that, like, you know, like metal music or rock music is just satanic, like, you know, like, everybody has their taste, right? Like, their taste in music and their things. But, like, one thing is, like, listen to music. And then another thing is to, like, act on these terrible offenses and, like, killing people.
In 1985, the game Dungeons & Dragons were even identified as a satanic ritual tool. Don't you play Dungeons & Dragons, Amy?
Are you calling me out? Yeah, actually, yeah, I do. And it's really fun, and it has nothing to do with Satanism or the devil or demons. And also, fun fact, Satanism, or like the word Satan, does not actually mean demon or devil or evil. It's like the direct translation from Hebrew to meaning opposing. So, like
Oh.
opposing religion, or opposing like beliefs, or opposing just like, like being on the opposite side of something. It does not mean devil or evil or anything. So, the more you know.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Didn't even know that. But anyways, when Ramirez began his killing spree, he presumably had enough pop culture knowledge to know what would terrify adults, and thus branding himself as a satanic figure. On August 30, 1985, Ramirez took a bus to Arizona to visit his brother, unaware that he had the lead story in a virtually every major newspaper and television news program across California. After failing to meet his brother, he returned to Los Angeles early in the morning of August 31. He walked past police officer who were stalking out the bus terminal in hopes of catching the killer. He attempted to flee on the outbound bus and into a convenience store in East Los Angeles. After noticing a group of elderly Mexican women fearfully identifying him as El Matador, Ramirez saw his face on the front page on the newspaper rack and fled the store in panic. After running across the Santa Ana Freeway, he attempted to carjack a woman, but he was chased away by a bystander who pursued him. After hopping over several fences and attempting to more carjack, he was eventually subdued by a group of residents, one who had struck him over the head with a metal bar in the pursuit. The group had Ramirez down and recently beat him until the police arrived and took him into custody. That's such a, like, a happy ending, I guess.
It's actually kind of funny when you see it in the documentary, how like people are just like ganging up on him and beating him up and calling him names. And I don't know, I just think it's a great thing that this community, these civilians, these regular people just came together as a collective and a group to stop this murder, and recognized him, and we're like, we're gonna do something about it instead of hiding.
Yeah, exactly. Plus his own type of people, his own people, Mexican. He was also Mexican too.
Yeah, like their own.
They had enough.
Yeah, shout out to Hispanics and Latinos, unlike the police.
Police are always so useless.
Behind. They're behind on everything. If you guys haven't watched the documentary, you definitely should. It's really chilling again, but you just see how behind and frustrating the cops were.
And way more detailed on how he killed his victims.
Oh yeah.
On September 20, 1989, Ramirez was convicted of all charges, 13 counts of murder and 5 attempted murder, 11 sexual assault, and 14 burglaries. During the penalty phase of the trial, November 7, 1989, he was sentenced to death in California gas chamber. And that's it.
Wow. So,
Justin have been served.
yeah. Like, he definitely deserved that. And again, just, very sick and twisted people, but we love watching and hearing about them. So that was interesting. Thanks for, taking me down this path of
Journey.
murders. Yeah.
I just didn't think, since a lot of people are always like, oh my god, I wish I lived in the 80s or the 90s. They don't really understand that the 80s was really a dangerous era.
It really was. I'm starting to realize that. And you know what? I think it's okay that, I'm living here now with technology and protection and security. And even then, things happen.
Still,
Yeah,
people
but
go missing and you don't know what.
yeah. But again, the general message for everyone and everything is to
Lock your doors.
Lock your doors, everybody, because anyone could be watching you and just come in.
When you least expect it.
So that's all, you guys. Thanks for joining us on this podcast. My heart goes out to all the victims. Stay safe, everyone, and until then, lock your doors.